Coming up on Path to Zero.
I think that the way that we talk about climate continues to be in the vernacular of shared sacrifice. This is not shared sacrifice. This will be the largest wealth creation opportunity that human beings have ever seen.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. Very happy to have you along for what promises to be another really interesting conversation about the journey we're taking to a low-carbon future. This time, we're focusing on the U.S. Department of Energy's efforts to roll out billions of dollars in grants to stimulate the transition to a clean energy economy. The Biden administration has tapped clean energy entrepreneur Jigar Shah to lead the department's loan programs office, and we're really pleased to welcome him as our guest on this episode of Path to Zero. Jigar is well known for bringing clean energy technologies to commercial scale as the founder of the pioneering solar firm Sun Edison, and then the billion-dollar green infrastructure investor Generate Capital. He's an author, speaker, podcast host, and we're looking forward to talking with him today on the role the Department of Energy's loan program has in the clean energy revolution. Jigar, welcome to Path to Zero, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's really great to be here.
I have really enjoyed preparing for this, and I eventually want to talk about your book, Creating Climate Wealth. I want to talk about a lot of the things that you have written about yourself and things that have been written about you, but let's start by talking about the importance of the LPO, the Loan Programs Office, where you're leading $40 billion of investment in large-scale clean energy projects that tackle the climate crisis. Tell us about the LPO.
Well, you know, The Loan Programs Office was really conceived of by Senator Domenici back in 2005 during the Energy Policy Act, and was later given more resources in 2009 during the ERA stimulus bill under President Obama. And that's really been its heyday, right? So it put out about $35 billion in loans in 2010 and 2011. Most notably for, you know, companies like Tesla, but also for companies like First Solar and SunPower and some of those kinds of companies as well. I mean, at the core, the Loan Programs Office recognizes that not all good ideas get access to capital, that there are a lot of good ideas where the traditional banks in the United States are just spending resources on these loans to be a bit problematic, a bit annoying, a bit outside of their purview. And so when you think about in 2010, utility scale solar and wind, which today, you know, get money at very cheap rates, were just viewed as annoyances by the major, you know, big money center banks, to the point where we provided about $5 billion in loan guarantees in 2010, 2011. And even after we provide those loan guarantees, the broader marketplace wasn't really open for business until 2014. And so when you think about the role we play in building a bridge to bankability, that bridge to bankability is very difficult to put in place. And it takes a lot of, deliberate work, but also a little bit of magic.
Very, very much so. And it's fascinating as you talk about, and we'll talk about it a lot more and later on as we think about kind of the balancing the today versus tomorrow. And I know you have a special emphasis on today. One of the quotes I love about you as I was studying, that you were selected to run the Loan Programs Office because you were going to make it more exciting and more accessible. Tell me how you do that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've focused on in my career is, not really being stuck up on you know, on who I am and what program I'm running and all that stuff. So the first thing I did when I came in was I filled up my calendar with one-on-one reach outs to over 200 CEOs of companies that I knew would be eligible for the loan programs office, right? People in green hydrogen, people in carbon sequestration and storage, people in plastics recycling, you know, people who were building electric vehicle manufacturing facilities, battery manufacturing facilities, critical minerals folks. And people appreciated it, you know, like it's one thing to see a bunch of, you know, good articles in the Wall Street Journal or Politico or other places. It's another thing to really get a reach out from somebody and say, you know, like I spent a half an hour asking my tough questions and figuring out whether this was really worth my effort. Because that's at the end of the day, what people are doing is they're saying, is this worth my effort? I'm so busy and I have so much opportunity in front of me, which is what really the climate decarbonization effort really is, a whole bunch of opportunity for the private sector. And the question really becomes, what role does a loan programs office play? Can it really help me unlock the opportunity of my technology? And if it can, then I'm happy to engage. And luckily, we have about 60 plus applications that are actively being prepared to come into the loan programs office as a result of those phone calls and then the many more that our outreach team is doing now.
I notice that you really invest across a spectrum of technologies. There was, in this current program, there's $8.5 billion towards innovation in fossil fuels. There's almost $11 billion in advanced nuclear, almost $18 billion in advanced technology for vehicles, which I always appreciate that. And then about $4.5 billion in renewable energy. So as you look across that spectrum, is there one area of clean energy that excites you the most?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say that in general, I try not to get excited. I'm a, you know, I provide senior debt, right? So I'm trying to figure out how we actually get people to use our resources in a way that is egalitarian, but also in a way that, you know, provides this catalyst to the private markets. And I mean, one area that I would say that I'm more interested and more excited about than most is in, you know, the justice area. You can imagine when I came into office, the president had laid down his principles around Justice 40, where 40% of all the benefits from all the public dollars should go to justice communities. And I recognized that the Loan Programs Office really didn't have a plan to be a part of that goal. And so I've worked with the, you know, roughly 147 people in our office to figure out what a good plan would be. And I think one of the ways that we figured out how to be relevant here is through, you know, figuring out how to bring residential finance to the masses in a way that is fair and equitable, but also in a way that really supports demand flexibility and demand response to help strengthen our grid with virtual power plants. And so that's been very exciting work and, you know, definitely has involved many people within the office.
Hey, talk to us more, because I know I read some of your work about justice and you always talk about virtual power plants. Explain to our listeners more about what a virtual power plant is and perhaps how it helps leverage environmental justice.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of ways to explain this. One is that there has been a movement around residential solar financing for years, right? 11 years to be exact. There's been portfolios of customers that have asked to, you know, buy solar as a service for their homes. And some of them are leases and some of them are loans. And there are very large companies to the point where they're doing about $1.2 billion of financings a month, right? So it's a pretty active marketplace. And that group of people have gotten respect from Wall Street banks such that they're capable of actually of accessing very low cost securitization dollars from, you know, first getting credit ratings from S&P and Moody's and Kroll and then getting cheap dollars. On the other hand, when you think about what happened in Texas during the polar vortex, there were a lot of stories of people who actually ran their houses on their Ford F-150 truck, right? Or ran their houses on their Chevy Bolt or their, you know, Tesla. And so people started thinking, wait, that's possible? To the point where all of the advertising for the F-150 Lightning has included this feature in the advertising. I don't know if you remember, but you know, they were advertising the F-150 Lightning during the entire Olympics. And every one of those ads featured the fact that you could run your house off the F-150 Lightning. And so people started saying, wait a second, can I really run my house off of that? And so, and then the third thing is you've had all of these summer heat waves, particularly in the West, but also in other places as well, like New York City. And there has been large news stories that have been done by the state of California, Texas, and New York City, saying that they were appealing to residential customers to shift their load in order to save the grid. And so residential customers responded by doing so, increasing the temperature on the thermostats, shifting their water heater load so that it was off peak. And so what you're finding is that the technology exists to provide people a 1 minute decision on whether they qualify for a loan. The technology exists to run your house off of your electric vehicle, and the technology exists to gang all of these appliances together in one software package to be able to act like a virtual power plant when the grid needs it to be able to respond to weather events. And so that in a nutshell is what the virtual power plant does. And from a practical standpoint, it means that, you know, when your air conditioner stops working, that's when you replace your air conditioner. Most people don't replace it beforehand. At that moment, you're going to get access to financing, you know, for 10 years at a very cheap interest rate. And if you want that cheap interest rate, you have to choose an energy efficient unit that actually allows for being able to subscribe into these demand flexibility markets. And people really love it. So that's a lot of what this is really about.
Yeah, really interesting. And maybe it's a great time to pause and say thank you. I really have always appreciated that you have such a business mind inside a political environment, and you seem to be very much one foot in the here and now and one foot in the future, and really thinking about that transition from now to the future. So I want to stop and compliment you. Jigar, it's time for a break, and then we'll get right back into this great conversation in just a moment.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a future of zero emissions starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, Clean American Energy. Learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us.
Welcome back. Our guest is Jigar Shah, Director of the Loan Programs Office of the U.S. Department of Energy. You wrote a really interesting book, Creating Climate Wealth, Unlocking the Impact Economy, and you wrote that, or at least it was published around the third quarter of 2013. A lot of change since then. But, you know, if I were to kind of pull out the theme of the book, it is really about let's don't wait for new innovation, that let's deploy existing technologies today that get us to a near-term climate impact. So one of the things we talk about often is, you know, using low-carbon fuels, propane, natural gas, tends to decarbonize more today. And in fact, 38 states today, propane and natural gas are cleaner than the electric grid. But I find that a really interesting viewpoint is let's decarbonize today, which is the theme throughout your book. So two questions. What's changed since 2013, or nearly 8 years later from the time they were published? And then do you still tend to believe that it's really important to make steps today?
Yeah, I think one of the things that hurts innovation and hurts entrepreneurs more than anything else is that we say to people, you should wait for when a real breakthrough comes. And when that real breakthrough comes, it will provide you everything. Faster, cleaner, smaller footprint, like less hassle, you know, everything will be better, right? And so you should just wait. Don't deploy what's here now. And what that does is actually make sure that that breakthrough never comes, right? That breakthrough comes because people are investing into the deployment of solutions today, right? When I started in the solar industry, panel efficiencies were around 9%, 10%. Today, solar panel efficiencies are 22%, right? And the cost of a solar panel has come down by 90%. But that would have never happened had we not deployed the solar technology that we had available to us in 1995 when I entered the solar industry, right? The same thing's true for wind. And today, that same thing is true with hydrogen. The technology that we have to produce hydrogen is around since the 1950s. Norway has created hydrogen from electrolyzer technology for decades, right? And what we need is a learning curve, right? George W. Bush invested heavily in the hydrogen research and development work. And that hydrogen work has developed all these technologies. And so now we need to deploy them. When you look at the hydrogen earthshot that the Secretary of Energy has announced, most of that goal is simply going to come from scaling up the technology. We actually know exactly how we're going to reduce the cost of hydrogen to roughly $2.50 a kilogram. Now, that last drop from $2.50 a kilogram to $1 a kilogram will take additional R&D and innovation. But that comes from the fact that you're deploying today's hydrogen technology, right? And the same thing's true with electric vehicles. If people never bought the original Model S from Tesla, we wouldn't be where we are today with a Model Y and all these other innovations around the electric vehicle architecture. And so when you think about, I mean, I would suggest to you that we are very close to having electric airplanes. We are very close to having electric tractors. We're very close to having electric construction equipment. That would not be possible if people didn't buy the original Model S's, right? Which we helped provide a loan to build that factory. And so I think that people need to recognize that there are things that you can do today that you should feel compelled to deploy the technologies that save you money today, and know that by making that decision, you're unleashing future innovation.
Yeah, I think one of the things we say often is that perfect is the enemy of good. There are a lot of, I'll say, great, not even good solutions today that would advance decarbonization. And so many people seem to look past that. So I really am encouraged that a person, you know, in your role and your leadership, both in practical investment and also just in the conversation, I love to hear you talk about that. I would say for us, we see two areas, and you just talked about both of them, in transportation, medium and heavy duty, and then to a degree, agriculture and lesser degree, construction. You know, we certainly see that we have great options there in low carbon fuels, mainly around propane, that would significantly advance decarbonization. And then one day in another world, you and I'll talk about how propane and justice fit, because I think in many cases, the access to propane, the ability to move to renewable propane, the fact that propane is generally affordable, EIA would say it's one of the cheapest forms of energy out there. So for us, this decarbonization, justice, and access all fit together. So we'll talk about it. I know we are sure. Investing. One of the things we do is that we intend to invest, and our investments, we're invested with Cummins, which is public. We have a few investments that are yet to become public in the agricultural space, but we've changed the technology. We now have exceeded the thermal efficiency of diesel fuel. And I would tell you 5 years ago, I'm not sure we even thought that was possible. And now we're doing it, and it'll make a significant change in medium duty transportation, heavy duty transportation. So love that you are talking about those things that we have been invested in. And by the way, I don't think that's the general narrative. I think so many people are, you know, really believing that let's do nothing today and we'll wait for this magic and perfect, when in fact we could really significantly advance decarbonization, health, justice today. So I appreciate what you're doing there.
No, I agree with you, Tucker. And one thing I would say to you, just to highlight it, is the $17 billion that we have in the Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Program is for all technologies that significantly reduce carbon emissions in the vehicle space. So propane, as well as, you know, there's a company called Clear Flame that I think modifies diesel engines to be able to burn ethanol. All of these kinds of companies qualify. And so I think it's important for folks to realize that while electrification is interesting, because so many people can just charge at home, there's lots of other technologies as well that that are eligible for the money that we have and should be deployed as we, you know, continue to bring diverse solutions for American independence.
Right. And we're both investors, although we invest at a different level. But one of the things I feel comfortable in being certain of is that the battery technology of tomorrow is not really even on the drawing board today. And that, you know, we're going to see revolutionary change in how we store energy. And so, you know, we just kind of have to hold on and decarbonize until we get to that point, because I'm quite comfortable that is going to be what happens, is that the batteries that even you and I are seeing in the laboratories today are probably not the batteries that our children will actually use in their vehicles and their homes and stuff. And I'm a firm believer in innovation, but I think innovation is going to surprise us as to what direction it takes.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, just to put that in perspective, we have about, you know, 900 gigawatts or so of electricity generation capacity in the United States. The total amount of grid scale batteries that have been deployed in the United States is 1.6 gigawatts, right? So the notion that we've actually sort of accomplished our goals and grid scale batteries are now ubiquitous and everywhere, et cetera, is just not true. And the same thing is true with electric vehicles. I mean, when you think about how many vehicles we have in this country, about 180 million vehicles that are actively being driven, we have about, you know, a couple million electric vehicles on the road today. And so when you think about, as we start to get greater market share, implementation of storage on the electricity grid, as well as into batteries, into cars, I think you're absolutely right that you will see magnificent changes in battery chemistry and all sorts of other solutions that come to market.
I know you saw it in your early days of solar. I mean, for those who are listening and don't realize, you were certainly one of the pioneers in solar, certainly a pioneer in solar finance, but you firsthand know better than most about the last piece of this, which is just that human factor and resistance to change. And it all comes together. And I think that's the last piece that we really have to work on, is beginning to get people to see that, yeah, EV works well for transportation, but it probably does require a shift in the way they think about transportation and the way they actually perhaps do transportation sometimes.
Well, this is where the justice component, I think, makes such a big difference, right? Is when you think about justice, right, many of us were influenced by Barbara Heinrich's work and Nickel and Dimed right back in the late 90s, where, you know, you realize that poor people pay extra for everything, right, because they don't have the money for a deposit up front or whatnot. And so when you look at electric vehicles or you look at some of these other things, a lot of what we're talking about here is the ability to solve many problems at the same time, right? So when you think about, right now, we're all busy thinking about charging infrastructure, right? How do we build 500,000 EV chargers in the United States and the bipartisan infrastructure bill and all that stuff? But part of what we don't talk about is we have $1 billion a month of subprime auto loans. There are a lot of people who really need reliable transportation to get to work. They go to a used car dealer. The used car dealer sells them a car. The car, you know, proceeds not to work as well as they were advertised. And people end up with $700 to $800 a month in average cost just to keep the car running so they can get to work, while the rest of us compete over, you know, whether we can get a $199 lease or a $350 a month lease, et cetera. There are ways to package all of this together, an EV charger, an EV, And then even not even forcing people to sign up to 7-year leases anymore, but instead having monthly commitments, right? So every month you can move to a different car or a different thing, or if your situation changes, the car can be shifted. And all of that business model innovation is possible today because you have technology that knows where the car is at all times, that knows where the car's been charged, right? That knows that it's still in good working condition because of the self-diagnostic capabilities of the cars today, right? And so I think we're in a weird situation right now where people are still stuck thinking in, you know, if you have a car with 100,000 miles on it, it's a piece of junk. Well, today with electric vehicles, a battery lasts 400,000 miles because it's actually defined in charge cycles, not in mileage, right? And so when you think about the way in which all of these assets are going to be valued in the future, they're far different than the way that we thought about in the past. And that allows you to create new models for the justice community.
Transportation, I get. And in my own opinion, transportation falls into kind of two buckets, right? There's consumer transportation, and then there's kind of the B2B segment. And even in the B2B, I look at UPS as a classic example. UPS will run LNG, CNG, they're running 1,500 propane vehicles today. I don't have no idea how many EV they're running. When it comes to buildings, though, there's a kind of an overarching thought that says the only path to a clean climate is through building electrification. There are certain technologies, I think, in buildings that really do lend itself to, again, I'm always talking about low carbon fuels. I'm never talking about oil, or I'm never talking about coal, but water heating, building heating when it's very cold, kind of in that conversation about today versus 2 decades from today. Because again, I'm quick to say 2 decades from today, the grid will be materially different than it is today. But we look at the grid today in 38 states, propane and natural gas are cleaner than the grid today. So making this migration to an electric world would only, to a degree, increase carbon while the grid's so dirty. Can you see the role that low carbon fuels like propane or natural gas play in portions of buildings?
Well, more than that, I've been a part of promoting these fuels as an alternative, right? So I mean, I absolutely see a role for them to play. I think that where we have to be a lot more mindful is really with fuel oil. In my opinion, I totally agree. I think the fact that we haven't been able to get the propane, natural gas industries and the heat pump industries together to eliminate fuel oil seems to me like a lost opportunity. There really shouldn't be. I mean, you remember, you know, EDF negotiated a deal to bring in like number two diesel or whatever into buildings in New York City to move them away from something that was like dirtier. I thought that whole thing was crazy. Right. Yeah. And so, like, I think if we could find a way to actually eliminate fuel oil, which really does have direct implication to people's lives being shorter because of,
you and I are in a hunt. I mean, we could eliminate. I go to ports. I go to some places that are using fuel oil or diesel fuel, which is essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's the essential. It's like cavemen burning wood. On the show, we have the one thing nobody else has. We have a magic wand. And you get to use that magic wand to change one thing, just one thing, and it has to be relatively timely in the next year. So what would you use your magic wand to change regarding climate, the energy conversation overall? What would you change or like to see done differently to dramatically improve our ability as we move towards a low-carbon future?
Well, I think that the way that we talk about climate continues to be in the vernacular of shared sacrifice, that we all need to have shared sacrifice to get to a more climate positive future. And I think in general, this is not shared sacrifice. This will be the largest wealth creation opportunity that human beings have ever seen. And that in general, it will improve the lives of everyone it touches, whether it's people who move to more energy efficient appliances, people who move to more, you know, climate friendly transportation, whether it's like all these other things. We already have all these things, but if I had a magic wand, I would move the entire conversation from shared sacrifice to the greatest, you know, wealth and job creating opportunity of our time.
Yeah, well said. It's so interesting as you read a lot about this. A lot of people do talk about shared sacrifice, and we also see it's kind of turning into a developed country versus developing countries. Clearly, different positions from both. And I think, as I think again about human factors and how we move forward, we have never thought about how to go backwards. We always are thinking about how to increase GDP, how to increase wealth, whether it's individual or nation's wealth. So completely agree with you that we have to move forward without thinking about sacrifice, because I don't think history ever shows that that's been the way, you know, we win by thinking about how to go backwards. So great point. Anything else? We're thinking about wrapping up now, but anything else that you would love to tell us about maybe what you're doing or what the LPO is doing? Anything you want to tell our listeners?
Well, the one thing on that point that I would mention is that, you know, 87% of appliances are replaced at their end of life, right? Your refrigerator craps out and you decide to buy a new one, right? Your water heater stops working, you buy a new one. HVAC system stops working, you buy a new one. And so as a result, every one of those moments is a moment to talk about climate change, right? Is really to talk about how we convert ourselves to a better, more interesting way to move our own household consumption into this broader narrative. And now with demand flexibility and, you know, demand response, we have the ability to actually get paid for all that flexibility, right? Under FERC Order 2222, once you buy a demand flexible appliance, you have the ability to get paid to participate in providing grid services. And so part of what I want people to understand is that at the moment that their appliance fails, you're actually being given the ability to create an income producing asset for yourself, as opposed to what you thought before, which was, oh crap, you know, like my refrigerator went out. Now I have to go buy a new refrigerator, which is, you know, an expense. And so I think that as we move through this transition, this is going to be just really powerful changing of the way we think about all of these, you know, decisions that in the past were things that we were afraid of. There are a lot of folks who know that their refrigerator is on the fritz and they're afraid because they don't have $800 sitting in an account somewhere to replace it with. Well, going forward, it's actually going to be a real opportunity to move to being part of getting paid for demand flexibility.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you very much. Last thing we do on this show that's a lot of fun is we thank you with a virtual gift. We started planning a virtual national forest. We do call it the Propane National Forest, but we really use it to thank guests for appearing on Path to Zero, and we plant a tree in your name. The one thing, you don't have to do one thing. You pick the forest. Now, a little homework. We know you grew up in Illinois. We've done some work with the Shawnee National Forest in Southern Illinois, but that's just one option. But do you have a favorite forest somewhere that would allow us to plant a tree in your name and in your honor for this show?
Well, you know, I went to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and so I know the Shawnee Forest very well. So I think that would be a wonderful one to choose. I absolutely loved growing up in Illinois and going to school at the University of Illinois, and so that would be a great honor to pick that one.
Well, you have that. We will get that done here very promptly, and Illinois will have one tree to add to it. And I do love that. That's a great university and a great college town. So thank you so much. Look, I cannot wish you well enough. I hope you are successful with all your efforts in Department of Energy. I want to thank you for what you're doing. I want to thank you for even the thought you bring. And I know for me, it gives me great comfort to know people who are really thinking about this from a private entrepreneurial perspective are advising people at very high levels in DOE. So thanks for that. And thanks for spending time with us today.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us. And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts.